Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Irvin Weathersby Jr. about his fascinating new book, In Open Contempt, Confronting White Supremacy in Art and Public Space. Irvin Weathersby Jr. is a New Orleans native who now lives in Brooklyn, where he teaches at Queensboro Community College and at City College of New York in the MFA Creative Writing Program. It's a pleasure to welcome him to The Reading Life to talk about his first book, A Grand American Odyssey titled In Open Contempt, Confronting White Supremacy in Art and Public Space. Irvin Weathersby, I'm so happy to meet you. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much, Susan. I was really looking forward to this interview.
Now, this really is a grand American odyssey, and it begins in, well, it begins way far back, but for our purposes, it begins in 2017, when you venture onto the neutral ground of then Jeff Davis Parkway to check out the bust of Charles Drew and the three white supremacists who were guarding it. And this was during that turbulent time when the Confederate statues were being removed and you had an encounter with them. So would you tell us about that?
Yeah. So, you know, in March of or the spring of 2017, these monuments came down in New Orleans, as we all remember. And I was living in Brooklyn at the time. I was actually planning my wedding. And as soon as I got married, I told my wife, look, I got to go down there. I have to feel this energy. This is a pivotal moment, not just in New Orleanian history, but in American history. Mm-hmm. So I go down there and I say, look, I'm going to, my plan is to look at all the monuments that were taken down, right? And in the process of looking at the ones that were taken down, I'm going to look at some of the ones that are still up. And so I pull up. And I'm you know, at Connell and then Jeff Davis, and I see these three people sitting under a tent surrounded by Confederate flags and MAGA flags. And my goal was to look at the pedestal of the former pedestal of Jeff Davis, but I couldn't really ignore what was happening across the street.
Sure.
And so, yeah, and so I sit there for a minute and I get the courage to kind of approach them. And what transpires is what happens in the opening scene of the book. I go there and we engage in, I think, mostly pleasant conversation. And we wind up having this discussion about the origins of the Civil War. And, you know, it becomes this really almost this powerful scene that sets up the rest of the book, where I'm engaging with others in similar fashions.
And it ends peacefully.
I think so. Yeah,
we no one.
Yeah. No one is injured, or at least physically. Yeah, it ends peacefully, and I think that's also a part of the book. You know, I want people to be inspired to face their fears, to speak to folks who may not necessarily share your opinions, and recognize that you can still come out unscathed. And in many ways, both of you could be uplifted.
And then we're off. We're off to see streets and statues all over the country and art, and to see history, or at least a version of it, that's set in stone. Now, one of the places you visit is the Whitney Plantation, and you go there, I think, three times, and you have three different kinds of experiences there.
Yeah. So, you know, the first time I go is a few months after it opened, and the news, I guess, about the opening of it was just so grand, and it was everywhere. And I was intrigued like everyone else. And so I go, but and when I go that first time, it's still kind of setting up. You know, there's some installations that are actually not available. And my first visit, actually, I couldn't see the big house because they were shooting a Disney film there. Mm-hmm. And I was really disappointed. But I said, you know, okay, I got to come back. And the second time I came back, I saw the big house, which offered a different experience. And then the third time I go back, I went on Juneteenth, and I was really expecting this huge or something grand in terms of programming and people being there. And I was really disappointed. Now, this was before Juneteenth became an official holiday, a federal holiday.
Right.
Yeah, but I go, and my third time, I am really taken aback. The biggest takeaway that I get from my third visit is the story of the 1811 rebellion. Mm-hmm. And there's an incredible installation there where there's a replication of 50 or so heads of the formerly enslaved people who were captured and decapitated. And their heads lined the plantation district on the German coast all the way to the center of the city. And this installation sought to kind of recreate what that mm-hmm. was. And in that process, I learned so much, not just about the rebellion, but I also learned about my own family story that I hadn't known. And that kind of takes me into different directions, takes me back into my own legacy, whereby I learned that the enslaver who thwarted the rebellion was actually the namesake of the street that my family grew up on.
Right.
And so that realization is another thing that I want people to experience. The more you kind of engage with everything that is a part of you in terms of art and public spaces, the more you realize that these spaces and these artworks reflect our own lives. You don't have to read a bunch of books. You don't have to have a PhD to engage with art. You just have to kind of be open to sitting in silence until the work itself reveals something to you.
And they also reflect our national priorities in so many ways.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your search also includes, this is so interesting, sites of interest for Indigenous people. So you mm-hmm. visit Mount Rushmore, and you visit the site of the Wounded Knee Massacre. And mm-hmm. those parts of the book are fascinating to me.
You know, that might have been my favorite part to write.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, so... You know, one thing that I often am grateful for is just my own curiosity. That's just the way that I was kind of wired. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I've always been a student. I've always been in schools, whether I'm a student or a teacher. I feel like my whole life of, you know, in many ways has been involved in being in schoolhouses. And so that chapter was an incredible education for me. I went seeking to understand what Native life is like now. I think one of the most contentious sites that is still erect in New Orleans and may always be is Jackson on the horse in Jackson Square.
Oh, sure.
Jackson. Yeah, in front of St. Louis Cathedral. And, you know, as I sit and as I go on the river, every time I come home, I always find myself on the river walk and really just trying to kind of meditate on this one being home, but also like everything that New Orleans is, I think, is encapsulated in that space, right? And you get this incredible view of Jackson in front of St. Louis Cathedral. And I just wonder, like, will we ever get to a moment where we can take Jackson to task? I know he was a president, and I know that he's on our money, he's on our currency, but he's also the architect of the Trail of Tears, which...
Right.
Systematically decimated Native populations. And so, you know, as I'm thinking about all of the things in my city and, you know, thinking about the American experiment, I say, well, look, I got to go there. I got to go to South Dakota. My great-grandmother also told me that her grandmother was Cherokee. And so I also feel some sort of kinship as I traverse up the Mississippi, as it were, to South Dakota. And, you know, I just learned so much about Native life, Native art, and how they view Mount Rushmore, right? Mm-hmm. How they view Crazy Horse, how they view statuary and symbolism. And another thing that I want people to take away from this book, in many spaces, I'm not going with these preconceived notions. I'm not going to try to have these gotcha moments. I'm truly open to the experience. I want to sit there and allow everything to kind of wash over me. And as I'm talking to Native artists, there were a lot of conflicting opinions.
Right.
You know, some people say, hey, look, we should not erect Crazy Horse on a monument or on a mountain and desecrate our sacred lands because the white man did, because they put, you know, Washington and Jefferson and Lincoln and Roosevelt on one of our other sacred sites. Why should we, you know, respond in kind? Is there another way to kind of address the trauma? You know, is this really going to bring Crazy Horse back? And, you know, others say, yeah, no, I think it is important, right, to have this monumental symbolism, you know, in our own kind of space. But who is actually doing the monument? Who is the sculptor? And so there were so many fascinating lessons that I've learned there. You know, one, the Crazy Horse Memorial is going to be 10 times larger than Mount Rushmore.
Yeah.
But it also likely won't be finished in our lifetimes. Right?
It's amazing. I'm so glad you have pictures in there, too.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to include more, but, you know, publishers are, they only give you so much room and leeway. But I'm working towards to try to create, you know, maybe almost like a teacher's guide and you know, on my website to kind of have people engage with more of the imagery as well. A number of people have been asking me about that, like, wow, I wish I could see more. I was like, well, okay, I'll figure that out for you.
Now, there's one morning where you're in South Dakota and you're getting ready to visit the reservation and you write, I ate the continental breakfast at my hotel like I had every morning of my stay. But this morning, a white boy, maybe 12, sat with his family at a table across the room with a sweater emblazoned with a bald eagle at its center, the sleeves patterned like Confederate flags. What a way to set the tone for the day. Go looking for white supremacy, find it everywhere. Go looking for nothing. Find white supremacy everywhere. Look, white supremacy everywhere. Now, this to me is like perfectly emblematic of African-American fatigue.
Mm.
You know what I mean? You conveyed that exhaustion so beautifully in that moment.
Yeah, you know, that's one moment. And I think to your point, there's many other moments in the book. I think there's a really pivotal moment when you find out where I get the title from. There's so many moments where, as a Black person whose family, you know, has sacrificed for this land, and as a person who's born after the Civil Rights Movement, a person who can exercise a number of freedoms that my ancestors can't, I think we're lulled many times to believe that we are free, or we have a certain sense of agency. And, you know, without fail, it seems like there are reminders almost every day, everywhere you look, of our oppression, right? Which is
right.
Where the title comes from, this idea of an open contempt, like a hatred for my kind is everywhere. It's open. It's in the public consciousness. And, you know, you can see with the current administration and many of the directives and executive orders that it's seeking. You can see, you know, across state houses, across the country, where certain books are banned, where histories are being told inaccurately, right? The idea that the Florida legislature believes that slavery actually benefited, you know, African Americans. You know, so these are almost comical and farcical in the sense of that this is our reality. And I think that's what the book is trying to capture, you know, the moment where I tell the readers where I get the title from is I'm in Paris, I'm with my fiance, and we are prepared to actually go explore art, you know, in the Louvre, and it's a beautiful day, and we're just excited. I'd never been to Paris. And across the street from us, my wife steps into a store briefly, and I'm just kind of taking in the beauty and all of the potential of the day. And right across from me, I see this relief installed on the facade of a building that is clearly an advertisement for slavery.
Right.
And I'm just deflated, you know, and it's just like there's so many moments, whether it's in public spaces, it's in our news, it's on our, you know, our televisions, where we're reminded that this country doesn't necessarily care for us as much as it should.
And yet you persevere. I mean, this is a book that covers a lot of time in real estate, and you kept going. I mean, you just put in the time and put in the travel.
Yeah, I mean, I kept going because I'm curious and I am optimistic. I, you know, I think the book ends in a place of optimism where there is the opportunity to right a lot of these wrongs. I think I'm still in that space, although it's hard, it seems, every day, because the book was finished before the current administration was elected. And now I think there's, as you said earlier, there's incredible fatigue, not just from Black folks, from I think the a lot of minorities or even the global majority, people who recognize that what is being espoused from the White House and our government is really about white supremacy. There's no, they're not hiding it. Like, we are not going to give aid to the rest of the world. We're going to rename bodies of water. We are not going to recognize that people have gender diversity. It almost seems so bizarre that it's unreal that this is the time that we're living in. And I think that's what the book is conveying.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Irvin Weathersby Jr. about his fascinating new book, In Open Contempt, Confronting White Supremacy in Art and Public Space. One of the other things you bring to this book that is so interesting to read is you bring the heart of an art historian. I think deep down when you mention that 10-pound Janssen's history of art, everybody yeah. knows what you're talking about. And you go to see, one of the works you go to see was so controversial and interesting is Carol Walker's Sugar Baby in the former sugar factory in Brooklyn, which is an amazing work of art, and you devote a lot of time to that.
You know, I inserted this whole notion that I wanted people to be clear that I'm not an art historian so that people could recognize that they could also have these experiences, right? And I think we're all artists in many ways. You know, one of the things I do almost like an icebreaker when I talk to people, I was like, okay, so what's your art form? What's, you know, how are you an artist? And some people are just like, I don't know what you mean. Like, what do you think? You know, what are you saying? Like, you don't know me. And then sometimes people realize like, wow, I guess I am a really creative cook. That's my artistry. Or, you know, I'm really into music or fashion or this or that. And I do that to really just illustrate that, as I said before, that we all have the capacity to engage with art. Mm-hmm. You know, we are, you know, the often the creators of art. We are often the subjects of art. And as a result, we have complete license to engage with it. And so I preface, you know, a big part of the book with that exchange and say, hey, look, you know, you can walk through museums, you can look at, you know, installations, you can look at public spaces and feel empowered to know what's there and to feel like you know what's going on. But at Carol Walker's Sugar Baby, I love Carol Walker first. I just want to say full stop.
Uh-huh.
And I knew what to expect. I knew, you know, Carol Walker's work is going to provoke, is going to make you feel something that maybe you like, you don't like. But when I went there and I go on the last day and it's line, at, you know, it's like a 2-hour line, but I was like, I got to see this. I know this is important. And I go there and it almost was like her work was almost too effective. Like I was struggling to fight back tears because the story that she conveys in terms of the origins of this country being founded on the rape of Black women was just so overwhelming. Mm-hmm. You know, all of my senses were exhausted because you can still smell the production of sugar in this space, this acrid, sour odor.
Yeah.
And then you see this massive, massive sculpture of a woman, you know, who's nude, and she's positioned as a sphinx, and just the imagery was just overwhelming. Yeah, and so I sit with that, you know, just to really try to understand and get into, well, what is the root of this country? Like, what are the real origins of this country? And then that chapter, I really just kind of follow the artistry of Black women and really try to honor Black women, not just the women in my own family, but the Black women artists who are really pushing the narratives, really pushing us trying towards a more equitable present.
Well, read for us a little bit, if you would, from An Open Contempt.
Certainly. When I look out onto these totems to the myths ascribed to New Orleans, I see the oldest cathedral in the country, which honors a king who waged war against Muslim and Jewish ideologies, next to a building where the Louisiana Purchase was commemorated, a document imbued by mysticism that transferred the unknown to the undeserving. Now it lives as a museum detailing the exploits of Andrew Jackson in the Battle of New Orleans, a fight that was settled before it began, a foregone victory that pitted a ragtag band of troops against a flank of British men who died without learning of their country's concession. The legend of Jackson only rose and thrust him into the White House as a hero of the New World, one who secured a utopian vision for us all, save for the savages. Fronting the buildings, Jackson's equestrian statue seems caught in a victory lap, his posture relaxed and kept to onlookers as if to say, "You're welcome," or "Just doing my job," or as a prelude to his next trick, the not-so-magical Indian Removal Act. Try as I might to worship at this altar, I find it hard to focus because I see something else. I know what happened along River Road when we fought for freedom. The fiction is fractured as I see the heads of black men on pikes planted in front of the church to remind us that we lost the 1811 uprising. Like young trees planted on scorched land, they stood to remind the slavers that order was restored. Life would carry on as it had before, until Jackson came along to save slavery and the city again. Then it would become the New Orleans you know, the postcard image disseminated throughout the world to evoke the sublime experience conveyed by the city's motto, "Laissez le bon temps rouler," or "Let the good times roll." Later, President George W. Bush would use it as a backdrop to talk about recovering from a storm, like that time President Andrew Johnson did the same in the neighborhood where my origin story begins. Somewhere along the river, an illiterate black man from Mississippi worked on a wharf to feed his family in the Norlite Ward, though he would only be paid if he was one of the lucky stevedores selected to risk his life loading and unloading cargo from ships docked at the Port of New Orleans. His fifth child became my father, and when I stand there along the river's edge, I think of my ancestors, my grandfather's grandfather, who may have found work along the river too, although he was probably the work transported to the markets that lined its banks, his labor valued more than his humanity.
Ah, such a beautiful book. We've been talking with Irvin Weathersby Jr., whose new book is In Open Contempt, Confronting White Supremacy in Art and Public Space. Irvin, thank you so much for your time and generosity.
Oh, thank you so much, Susan. This was great.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Tamron Hall signs Harlem Honey, The Adventures of a Curious Kid, Sunday, March 30th from 11 to noon at Garden District Bookshop. Novelist Brenda Jackson signs Spilling the Tea, Tuesday, April 1st at 6 at Baldwin & Company. James Beard Award winners Nina Compton and Osei Endelin discuss and sign their new cookbook, Creole, Recipes, Stories, and Dings from a St. Lucian Chef's Journey, Wednesday, April 2nd at 6 at Octavia Books. The big three literary festivals are winding down this weekend. The fourth New Orleans Book Festival at Tulane University ends Saturday, March 29th. Check out bookfest.tulane.edu for complete listings. The big event Saturday, March 30th is Family Day from 10 a.m. to 2 with book giveaways sponsored by Scholastic and many local authors on hand and children's activities. Our picks for the other events are Bob Woodward discussing his book War at 11:30 at McAllister Auditorium. Maureen Dowd discusses Notorious, Portraits of Stars from Hollywood Culture, Fashion, and Tech with Ken Auletta. That's Saturday at noon in the Kendall Cram Room in the Lavin Burning Center. From bestsellers to blockbusters is a conversation with John Grisham and Michael Lewis, moderated by Michael Linton, Saturday at 2:30 in McAllister Auditorium. The 39th Tennessee Williams in New Orleans Literary Festival runs through Sunday, March 30th. Check out tennesseewilliams.net for the complete schedule. Our picks. If you're a lover of crime fiction, check out Saturday's Diana Pinkley Prize programming, which celebrates 10 years of that award, a New Orleans-based endeavor. Our picks for the weekend, Friday, March 28th at 4, Empty Shelves, a history discussion and reading of banned books with Maureen Corrigan, NPR's Fresh Air book critic, Michael Cunningham, Margot Duahi, and Jewel Gomez. Included in the conversation will be readings from favorite banned books. Saturday, March 29th at 11:30, Here Come the Girls, What Crime Fiction Tells Us About the Lives of Girls and Women, with Maureen Corrigan again, the book critic for Fresh Air, Megan Abbott, Alifair Burke, Gillian Flynn, and Laura Lippman, all previous winners of the Diana Pinkley Prize for Crime Fiction. Sunday, March 30th at 10, 1,000 Words Worth, The Relationship Between Photography and Writing, with writers Andy Young, Carolyn Hembry, Constance Adler, and photographers Josephine Sacabo and Jennifer Shaw. That's moderated by George Bishop Jr. Then the 22nd Annual Saints and Sinners LGBTQ Literary Festival ends Sunday. Check out sasfest.org for complete schedule. Closing ceremonies Sunday include a tribute reading to the beloved author, Dorothy Allison. Our picks, Saturday at 10, Practice Makes Perfect, How Writers Nurture Their Writing Habit, with Jonathan Alexander, Michael Cunningham, Jewel Gomez, Joan Larkin, and Donna Minkowitz, moderated by Elizabeth Nonis. And Saturday, March 29th at 4, To Be Young, Gifted, Queer, and Black, with panelists Christian Lee, Penda Smith, Malik Thompson, Ashley Young, and moderator Charisma Price.
Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.